The Foundation for Iranian Studies, the Oral History Program, interview with the Honorable John Macy, December 26, 1984, Washington, D.C. Interviewer, G.R. Afghani. Mr. Macy, would you be good enough to tell us something about your own background and perhaps how you came to know about Iran, what made you interested in Iran?
I would be happy to do that, and let me say, it's an honor for me to have this opportunity to talk with you on the record about my association with Iran. My career has been one of substantial diversity. I graduated from Wesleyan University with a liberal arts degree, a major in government and history, in 1938. I came immediately to Washington. At that time, the New Deal of Franklin Roosevelt was in its second term. There was widespread belief among young people at that time that the federal government could be a source for correcting some of the social and economic disabilities that the country had experienced during the Great Depression. I came, therefore, to Washington with great enthusiasm for the programs of that particular time. I was part of a program called the Government Intern Program. I was one of a group of about 55 recent college graduates who were brought to Washington under the auspices of an organization called the National Institute of Public Affairs. The internship consisted of a daytime assignment to one of the government agencies, to a member of Congress, to the media, to pressure groups. A great variety of Washington institutions were offered as places where a recent graduate could be exposed to the ways of Washington. My own selection was in the recently established Social Security Board. The statute had been enacted in 1935, 3 years earlier, and at that particular time, in 1938, 1939, the agency was in the process of setting up the administrative machinery for the implementation of that statute. In addition to that employment assignment, the interns assembled once a week to meet with some distinguished personality in Washington, ranging all the way from the President of the United States to his most bitter opponents in Congress, to members of the literati and of the media as well. We also engaged a number of academic programs at the American University Graduate School. The program that was arranged for us was in public administration. Most of us had not had a previous study in that field, so the academic background was also important. That program ran for a year. At the end of that year, I was fortunate enough to have passed the civil service examination, and I entered the government in the Social Security Board as an administrative assistant at the munificent salary of $2,000 a year, which was substantially better than most of my contemporaries were receiving in the private sector at that time. Shortly after the eruption of the war in Europe, I became increasingly convinced that the United States would be involved in that war, and that it was important, if I were to be a practitioner in public administration, that I have a greater involvement with the administrative aspects of rearmament and preparation. As a consequence, I had an opportunity to transfer to the War Department. I did so in November of 1940 and entered the civilian personnel field. This was really my initial launching into what became my primary specialty, that of personnel administration, or human resource management as it's called in this day and age. I served in the War Department in its civilian personnel division for the period from November 1940 until I was drafted into the service in June of 1943. During that period of time, the expansion of the civilian workforce within the War Department was enormous, from roughly 800,000 to more than 2 million. So that this was a very intensive experience in personnel administration. And I was fortunately on a ladder that moved up rather rapidly. And at the time I was drafted, I was the assistant director of civilian personnel. This was a bit shocking to some people, including certain members of Congress, who felt that a man at age 25 should not have a responsibility of that magnitude. However, I was very quickly reintroduced to the more humble life as a private in the United States Air Force. And I went through induction training and basic training, and then was assigned to an air base where I was assisting as a private the head of the civilian personnel operation. After a few months, I filed for and was accepted in the officer's training program and went through a 16-week intensive training and graduated as a second lieutenant. Once again, the system followed the pattern of selecting those who had experience for work in the same field, and I became involved in civilian personnel work with the ferrying division of the Air Transport Command. And our headquarters originally were in Cincinnati. I used to say in a jocular vein that I was fighting from a foxhole at the corner of Vine and Fifth Street in Cincinnati, and that was the closest I ever came to enemy fire during that period of time. I was not assigned to an overseas post until after the war was over. And since I had been in the service a relatively short time, I did not have many points which would permit me to be demobilized. So in June of 1946, I was given an assignment, and really my first overseas assignment, and my first assignment as an advisor. I was assigned to the U.S. group responsible for advice and assistance to the Chinese Nationalist Government. The acronym was MAGIC, the Military Advisory Group in China. And as a captain in the Air Force, I was selected to advise the newly appointed Minister of National Defense in the Chinese government to assist him in organizing his office for a combined, a consolidated defense organization. Of course, this was at the same time that the Civil War was continuing, and the Communist forces in the North, and with Chiang Kai-shek's government, with headquarters in Nanking, where I was stationed, endeavoring to hold their own. History reveals to us that they did not hold their own until they went to Taiwan a year after I was there. Some of my friends have teased me by saying, obviously, I contributed to the demise of that government. But I was there for several months, and was involved in working with general officers of the Chinese government in the structure of the organization to direct their total military establishment. Upon my return to the United States in the late fall of 1946, I returned to the civilian personnel office of the Secretary of War to a position as assistant director. But I remained for only 6 months. And during that period of time, I was convinced that the process of demobilization and of destruction of many of the organizational and personnel policies of the World War II was not as exhilarating as the expansion period had been several years earlier. And I was attracted to the newly established Atomic Energy Commission. It had been formed by a statute passed in 1946. And one of the men whom I admired most in the federal government became the chairman of the Atomic Energy Commission. And that was David E. Lilienthal. And I was convinced that under his leadership, there would be an appropriate emphasis upon the peacetime applications of nuclear power. But here was an opportunity to do a pioneering job in public administration, because many of the units that became a part of the Atomic Energy Commission were transferred from the military. In many cases, they had been under the command of military officials that I had known during my days in the Office of the Secretary of War.
So may I interject and ask one question? Because obviously, Mr. Lilienthal is major going to be of great interest to the history of Iran.
He's a major actor in
the history. And this is the Atomic Energy Commission position for Mr. Lilienthal. Is this directly after the TVA?
Yes. Mr. Lilienthal had been one of the founding fathers of the Tennessee Valley Authority. He had been its articulate spokesman. He'd been one of its leaders as far as policy development was concerned. He had stimulated professionals in the public administration field with the nature of the management that he exercised there. He was called upon during World War II to utilize some of the TVA facilities for the development of nuclear power and for its application to weapon systems. The plant at Oak Ridge in Tennessee was largely fueled by the power systems that were developed in the TVA. And he became one of the major authorities in the country with respect to atomic energy. He and Dean Acheson formed a small committee under the direction of President Truman to study just what the international control should be. And there's a well-known Acheson-Lilienthal report. So he received increasing identification with atomic energy. And so when the statute was passed in 1946, he became the logical person to become the chairman. And so this was another public service experience that involved him. And as you say, he is an important figure in my story. And this was the first time that I had had direct association with him. I don't pretend that he selected me at this particular time. I happened to go to the commission because a number of the people that I had known in the War Department had become a part of that organization. I was there only a few weeks when I was asked if I would be moving to accompany the new civilian manager to the Los Alamos project in New Mexico. This was the most important research and development laboratory in the atomic energy system, and was in the process of converting from a military encampment to an organization which would be attractive to the top science in the country. And so, to make a long story short, I went out there for 90 days, and I stayed 4 years. And I became the director of organization and personnel, assistant to the manager, a man by the name of Carol Tyler.
This is in Los Alamos. Let me ask you something else. Los Alamos, is this the same as the Manhattan Project?
Yes. Los Alamos had been selected by Robert Oppenheimer for the Manhattan District. And it was the principal research and engineering center for the bringing together of the theoretical conditions developed with respect to nuclear power and their application in the weapon system. And so it was really the final stage. And the famous test at Trinity Site in New Mexico was conducted by the scientists from Los Alamos. The program was administered by the Manhattan District under a contract to the University of California. And that's where Oppenheimer had been. And when they were seeking a site for the laboratory, Oppenheimer remembered that as a young man he had lived in the Rio Grande Valley in New Mexico, and that there was a school at Los Alamos. And the War Department proceeded to acquire that school, and that became the site of the Los Alamos Laboratory. And that's where the principal work was done on the weapons that were eventually dropped upon Japan. So my arrival out there came a little over a year after the bombs had been dropped. After the Atomic Energy Commission had concluded that it would retain that site and convert it from a temporary wartime town and laboratory to a more permanent installation. And I was there during the period of time, 4 years, when that transition took place. Housing was constructed for people to live there. Shopping centers and recreational areas were constructed. We planned new laboratory buildings on a different mesa, separated by a canyon, so that we could open up the community and eliminate some of the security requirements. So it was, again, a very intensive learning experience for me in a great variety of management activities. To some extent, my role was that of a city manager, because we had all the problems of managing a city that a local government would have elsewhere. I left there in 1951 to return again to the Pentagon, this time as a special assistant to the Secretary of the Army, who at that time, late in the administration of Harry Truman, was headed by a former associate of mine from wartime days, Frank Pace, PACE. And my assignment with him was really a license to track down areas of waste and mismanagement within the Defense Department. And I pursued this with some vigor and with some lack of popularity on the part of those who happened to be fall under my questioning. The administration changed in 1952 with the election of President Eisenhower, and I remained for about 6 months under the new Secretary of the Army until I was invited to become the Executive Director of the United States Civil Service Commission. Civil Service Commission is a three-man commission. The Executive Director was the top career official that managed the agency. The agency was really the principal personnel office for the executive branch.
I just remember, what, 30? Is that it, 30?
Well, when I went to the Civil Service Commission in 1952, I was 35.
35, yeah.
And by that time, you see, I had about 13 years of government experience. And even though it was a Republican administration,
Jamshid Al-Musabah,
who was then the Minister of Finance of the government of the other line, served as the chairman of Ipsen. And as a consequence, we were frequently in communication at the time of the annual meetings and on other occasions as well. And we were what I would consider to be constructive colleagues in the interest of building a sound international civil service, not only for the United Nations, but for all the international countries. And through that association, I came to hear more and more about Iran. Social occasions, we were frequently discussing with me some of the efforts that were taking place in Iran to provide a modern government, to build economic development, to move forward on certain political fronts. And I was interested, but I had no particular
involvement. This is not the late 60s.
And that's not the first association was in 1966. Mm-hmm. And we met in 66, 67, 68,
mm-hmm.
and 69
mm-hmm.
in these annual meetings. Mm-hmm. Meetings that were held in Geneva, Paris, and New York. And when Dr. Busegar came to the United States for meetings of the World Bank, why, there was always an opportunity to meet with him socially. In 1969, President Nixon took office, and I departed from the government service. I guess you could say I was retired by the voters. If Humphrey had become president, I have no doubt that I would have stayed in the government for another 4 years. But I was fortunate in having another challenge, this time to become the first president of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This was an organization established by the Congress as a private corporation that could receive government funds and private funds, and had the mission to establish a system of public television and radio for educational and other illuminating purposes. Could there be a renaissance in that particular part of the country? The part of the country that had in Iran. You had been involved with the Kurdistan Water and Power Authority, which was modeled very much after the PDA. The Iranians who had served in that organization had advanced to key positions as ministers of agriculture and energy, transportation. And it had become a brotherhood in and of itself of the talented Iranians. And because of the presumed success in the Kurdistan with the building of the poverty dam, with extensive irrigation projects, with a certain health service projects, with efforts at the establishment of a sugar refining business using the cane that was growing in that area, there were significant participation on the part of American experts, but always with the view that they were there temporarily, that ultimately all of these systems would be managed by Iran. In addition to that, there were other projects. For example, a project to advise on development agriculture research in the Ministry of Agriculture, a program for the development of a national water fund, Ministry of Energy, a project that related to some of the banking facilities.
Myself for my present assignments and undertake this particular mission after I agreed to do it, and I told him that I'd got the idea to work it out so that Yeah.
But even so, I had the impression when I departed, late in October of 1978, that I would return. In fact, I set the date for January 4th.
Thank you.
also, we've tried, rather vainly, to do something about the refugee situation, particularly in Pakistan and Turkey. It's a limited effort. It was helpful in turning the directory on, largely through searching names of phone books, and there are at least 600,000 in the United States with clusters here in Washington, Southern California, Texas. And we have been in touch with those other communities as well as in Washington. The American government attitude toward Iran has never coincided with the attitude that they were moving on. We saw in 1977 to have an audience with President Carter to communicate directly rather than through the state on our experiences in conversation with the Iranian ministers. He thought he answered concisely and especially. But we're thankful for our offer, but I'm surprised they had plenty of information on us coming through official channel. A number of people have asked me, was I consulted at any time during the hostage situation in 1979, 1980? The answer is no. Neither was Mr. Allen's. This was done to be handled entirely by those who were officially responsible in the state department. And certainly I have had no communication, nor have I been asked for advice by the president.
Photographs of the American, a closer examination, I realized
called Integrated Development. He felt you didn't know a damn about it. You didn't deal with a total position in the valley that was to be served by that institution. So I know that there was controversy about the degree of exclusivity that they had, the questions as to whether there should have been more competition. But my feeling was, well, there still is, that it was very wise to have done this. Some, I know, have questioned whether it was necessary for Lilienthal and his company to stay there as long as they did.
Can we follow it on the other side of the table? Because I have a feeling we've come to the end of that thing right now.